Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our Soundbite episodes. That was an article in the New York Times. It was interesting, written by Gina Collada, who's been a guest on the show many times in the past. And it was Studies Question the Pairing of Food Deserts and Obesity. So I read it, and then I sent it over to our friends and colleagues at the Center for Livable Future that we've been doing a great deal of work with on this whole question of transforming the food system. And we're going to talk about how we define those food deserts and what that really means for the people living in them, if they do exist or not exist. Are we looking at it in the way that does more harm than good? And we're going to kind of try to capture some of that in this conversation with our two guests. Dr. Helen Lee, who is mentioned in the New York Times article and who's quoted in the article, is a policy fellow with the Public Policy Institute of California. And Helen Lee, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Ann Palmer is with us once again. She's Eating for the Future Program Director for the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. And Ann, good to have you in our studio.
Thanks for having me.
So let me just get you both to kind of define what you think that we even mean by a food desert, and if it even is the term we should be using. Let's start with Helen Lee.
I think food deserts have been, it's been loosely defined, I would say, both in the research literature and the policy literature. But the U.S. Department of Agriculture has come out and said a food desert is an area that is primarily comprised of low-income residents, where there is not access to a supermarket or grocery store, a place that sells healthy, affordable foods, that's not proximate to the residents there. And so they have a food desert locator map, I think, that shows if there's a low-income neighborhood that doesn't have access to a grocery store within a mile. And so that, by that, their definition, is a food desert.
And Ann Palmer, how do you define that? I mean, where is the root of it for you?
I think I would agree with Dr. Lee's definition in terms of, you know, it's just, it's areas of, you know, where low-income residents live that they don't have easy access. I think in Baltimore and at the Center for Livable Future, we've been working on a very specific definition that takes into account the context that people live in Baltimore City. And so we actually consider people who are more than a quarter mile from a supermarket, taking into account that if people are going to drive, that actually they're going to probably go farther than a mile if they actually have access to a car. We look at 185% of the poverty level. 40% of the households have no vehicle ownership. And then the next layer that we've just added is actually looking at the quality of the food of the stores, in the stores, that where people live. And we use the Nutritional Environment Measurement Survey to give the store a score and whether or not they have healthy food available in that store. And so if they have a low score, we score them a particular way. And then if they have a higher score, they get a higher score in terms of healthy food availability.
So is there a way that – I mean, do you think that the issue, Helen Lee, is that these definitions we give to food deserts are a mistake, that we end up moving up the wrong policy tree, thinking about how to address those issues of food and poverty? Is it getting in the way of that?
Well, I think there's a couple issues. One is that, you know, the idea of a food desert, I think is really powerful, and it suggests that, you know, there's just a dearth of options in low-income neighborhoods. And so the idea is that if you, as a public health practitioner or a policymaker, tell residents in these areas, you know, to eat better, to eat healthier, and to move more, and they don't have the tools to do that in their neighborhoods, then that's problematic. That comes off as, you know, insulting at best. But in what I found in my study, and this was surprising to me, was that low-income neighborhoods on average, and this is looking at the national level, they had greater access to fast food stores. That's a common finding. They had greater access to convenience stores, things like 7-Eleven, which aren't necessarily ideal or healthy because they stock a lot of junk foods. But they also had greater access to sometimes, depending on the measure, to large-scale supermarkets and grocery stores. And that was surprising. So the picture that I came away with was a portrait of easy access to lots of different food stores. Again, this was a pattern that I was looking at, not saying going into a neighborhood and saying, can I find a food desert, which I think is a different endeavor than what Anne is doing and trying to characterize what makes healthy eating hard.
Anne?
Yeah, I think I was really intrigued by your finding, and I think it actually – the findings, I think it is really – interesting to try and, you know, tease that out and say, what is it exactly that we're looking at and looking for? And I think, you know, one of the things in Baltimore City, we jokingly say, it isn't that we don't have enough supermarkets, it's that the markets that we have are not markets that people want to shop at oftentimes. So we have 44 supermarkets in Baltimore City, which is a significant number of supermarkets. But in fact, when you go into those markets, the quality of the food sometimes is not great. There are smells, people don't get treated right, just all kinds of problems that residents will express why they don't want to shop there. And that all leads to what I call kind of these shopping patterns that take people out of their neighborhood to get the foods that they want at a price they can afford. Because when they are, you know, a lot of low-income residents will maybe do one large shopping trip a month. And then maybe smaller trips. And so that one large trip is going to be to a store that has, you know, high-quality foods at a price they can afford. And so they'll go several miles. And, yes, they will usually take a car. And then they use, I think, the stores in their neighborhood more as filler stores outside of that main shopping trip.
Now, are we saying that this – a couple of things popped my head, the two of you were talking. Are we saying these things are just unique to Baltimore? I mean, we're hearing – clearly, that whether you're listening to Michelle Obama or the research that food deserts exist throughout urban areas in America, and not just urban areas, but you know we've found a lot of that conversation taking place in rural areas around the country as well. So,
I think what Michelle—I mean, take that back—not Michelle Obama's. What Helen made a comment. Yeah, Michelle Obama said this. What Helen was saying, that there's so many more stores, you know, in low-income neighborhoods. I think that is very true, and there's just so much more food in the United States now than we had even years ago. So you have so many opportunities to eat. You can you really never have to go hungry, and I think. When you have this density of food, any type of food, what types of food do we see getting marketed? We don't see foods, healthy foods getting marketed. You see unhealthy foods getting marketed. That's what's going to make more money for the food companies. I don't think that's unique to Baltimore, but I think what every – you have to look at the context of every city, and that you're going to find, you know, some differences in every city based on what's actually happening on the ground. But I think, you know, it's important to look at that system's – research and kind of take it back and say, what's the bird's eye view tell us? In Baltimore City, we don't have a lot of fast food chains in low-income neighborhoods. We tend to have more carryouts and convenience stores that are locally owned and are, you know, have mostly fried foods. That is a big difference than if you're going into a middle-income neighborhood and you see a lot more chain markets. You're not going to find those the same type of store. And I think that's one difference that we see and that I think Helen's research bared out as well.
Helen, would you like to tack on to that? I mean, I'm curious.
Yeah, I think the other question was, there was a food desert question. So what do low-income neighborhoods look like in terms of their retail food outlets vis-a-vis, you know, higher-income, wealthier neighborhoods? And it was a different portrait than I expected, given and it was, as I described, one of, you know, ease of access to lots of different food stores. And that makes sense because I think most low-income folks or minority folks live in inner-city urban contexts, which are really dense. And if you compare them to wealthier neighborhoods, those tend to be in the suburbs, which are not as dense. And there's lots of regulations against, for example, a McDonald's going up in their neighborhood. The other question, though, was whether this even matters. So whether what you have access to, given all these initiatives to invest in building grocery stores in poor neighborhoods, does it matter for the outcomes that we seem to care about, which are one of which is obesity? It's not the only outcome we should care about, but it's the one that I had a direct measure for. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter. And that actually wasn't a surprising finding to me, given a lot of literature that has questioned the relationship between access to food stores and weight outcomes. And I think because it's a lot more complicated, as Anne is suggesting, than what you have proximate access to. So how people make food purchasing decisions and what they consume isn't just about proximity. It's about price, it's about taste, it's about culture, it's about what feels good in the moment. It's about education, not just education about knowing that French fries are bad for you, for example, but education signaling empowerment and long-term thinking versus short-term thinking. I think these are the facets that are really interesting, and I think they're where research is pointing to, saying, you know, proximity isn't enough.
Does that fit with what you have been looking at as well?
Yeah, I do think that's a it's very true that, you know, we shortchange ourselves and the research when we just look for that, you know, saying, well, this is going to lead to this. And, you know, I think that, you know, obviously, you know, Helen, you were trying to tease that out, is that it's not enough. It's really more of a systems problem. I think one of the things that always strikes me when we're looking at this is what's happening at that supermarket level as well. So we're doing a supermarket study right now, and we just had done some qualitative interviews over the course of last summer. And one of the things we found is that a lot of the people – it's a supermarket located in a low-income neighborhood, and a lot of the people could identify healthy foods and had preferences for the foods, but there were other barriers that cost being one of them, but not the only one, that prevented them from purchasing those on a regular basis. And so it's a lot more complicated. So those are kind of, you know, from their own description of what's going on in their lives, what happens outside the store, how they make the decisions about where to shop. And then once they get into the store, how do they make those purchasing decisions? And, you know, what happens after they purchase? Can they – most low-income people cannot afford to buy food that they're not going to use. And so you really – you know, you don't take a lot of risks. You don't take a lot – you know, you kind of buy what you know your family's going to eat and what you can afford and how it's – is it going to last for the whole month? Is it going to – you know – lots of processed foods have a long shelf life. Fresh foods do not. If you're shopping once a month and you're trying to get enough fresh food for the month, that's almost impossible. You can, you know, frozen foods are a great alternative, and I think people do avail themselves of that, but it's maybe still not as desirable as.
So what for the two of you is at the heart of the problem? I mean, is it the heart of the problem access? Is the heart of the problem proximity? Is the heart of the problem cost? It's the heart of the problem that not just poor folks, but people, period, don't think about healthy eating anyway. I mean, it's what's quick and fast and on the run. You know, I mean, every day I come to the studio here, I'm blocked by everybody trying to get to the Burger King. I can't get around. So, you know, so I mean, what is it from both of your perspectives?
All of the above. I mean, that sounds so – it's that cop-out, right? I'm saying – but I do sort of feel like the way – and I'll say this, Helen, as I told Mark, I'm a meddling generalist. Like, I look at these issues from, like, an inch deep and a mile wide. And when I look at them across the scale, what I see is, you know, it's so hard to isolate the one thing. And there's so many different parts of that food system that we need to be able to affect in order to have some meaningful change. And that maybe the outcomes – immediately are not going to be childhood obesity rates or changes in health, but, you know, greater, you know, consumption patterns. A colleague of mine pointed out, you know, you can have people eating a lot more fruits and vegetables. That doesn't mean they're reducing their caloric intake. They could be eating a lot of the same foods, but you're still eating more fruits and vegetables. People sort of see, oh, it's just a replacement thing. Well, not necessarily. So it's a lot more complicated, I think, than energy in, energy out, and that you have to look at all the facets that are influencing that. So marketing, what counts on price, marketing, location, you know, I think from a purely economics point of view, you don't want to create demand for products that you don't have a supply for. So if that supply is not – I think it's not misguided to put supermarkets in areas that need a market and there's a demonstrated demand for it. But I also think you can't just put it there and say that you're going to have an impact on health outcomes. That's ridiculous and really makes no sense. So it's like what the other factors that go into, all the eating habits that we have and have acquired in this, food environment that now exists after 40 years of really dramatic changes in our overall, food system.
Hello?
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that obesity rates have risen among all groups.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just a problem among the poor, although, of course, we see disparities, and hence a lot of the initiatives to focus on low-income neighborhoods and low-income populations. But it's risen among highly educated people as well. And so we do live in a culture where food is really accessible, it tastes really good, it's really cheap. So these are the factors that sort of drive, why we are a fatter nation than we were before. We live very sedentary lives. I mean, there's lots of ways our lives have improved, but in ways that might have these alternate consequences, like we're seeing with obesity. To change that is really hard, I think, and it's hard for across the board. I think price does matter to some extent, but it's not the only factor. Because there are, for example, I think healthy products that are seasonal in the grocery store that are relatively cheap, for example. We went to the Target the other day, and the bananas were, which are not local, of course,
right.
They're 19 cents a pound, and they're really cheap. I mean, this is shocking in some ways how cheap things are. Lentils are very cheap, for example. So there's like healthy alternatives to the unhealthy counterparts that we can all think of. So this is just to say that price is an important component, but it's not the only one, again. And I think when you survey, the qualitative stuff that has looked at why low-income shoppers buy what they buy and what they report back, it's the number one thing is taste. Mm-hmm. And that's true for higher-income folks. These things, somehow we got these things tasting really good, and we started to make them for really cheap. And until we can make, hopefully we can make healthy food taste good and teach people how to make healthy food taste good, so it's not a chore, so it's not onerous to eat it. And one of the biggest factors across studies, not just mine, that predicts who's protected from weight gain over time, it's education. And education taps into a lot of things. Again, I don't think it's just about knowledge about caloric intake and good calories and bad calories. I think it is about investing in your health in a different way and saying, this might not, be the tastiest meal I can think of right now. Maybe I really do want that fast food meal. But because I know that's not good for my health, I'm going to choose the other option. And that's a sort of a long-term investment thinking versus the short-term. That's what I mean by that.
And I think once you start eating, if you are brought up in a household that eats a lot of processed foods and you develop a taste for that. And that's kind of, and I have friends who had this happen when they were growing up. And then to change those habits as you grow older and it's not as, quote unquote, good for you to be eating those types of foods, it's really difficult because you're predisposed to wanting those tastes.
Right.
That's your food.
Yeah.
It tastes good to you. And so when you're making those changes, like any diet, any habit that we try to change, it can be incredibly difficult to do, even if it's the right thing to do. You can have all the right information, but you just overcome.
But how much do you think that when we talk about choices we make, how much of that choice do you both think is completely individual will? This is the choice I'm going to make because I'm going to go buy this. And how much of it is there is the McDonald's or the Chick-fil-A or whatever it is, the Burger King, not to pick on just one. I'm going to try many as I can. Somebody. They're just being on one outlet. But there they are, and let's go. We can get this big, giant burger or this fat, greasy chicken and just tastes so good, and we're going to go get it. And that, coupled with the advertising that keeps telling us what it is we want to eat and how much soda we should be drinking and how you can buy this stuff so cheap, so go get it. I mean – so before we come back to this poverty and this issue, what about that? I think that affects all of us, no matter where we are.
It,
affect all of us. And I think that, but what's funny is that the kids that I see, and I do live in, you know, the East Bay, and it's, you know, it's an educated community, and, you know, the kids around me, they look at the McDonald's and they turn their noses, you know, and they've actually never set foot in the McDonald's, I think, even though there's one really close by. And I think that's their parents being, you know, very foodie-ish,
right.
And
yeah.
Saying,
right.
Yeah, that's junk. You would never want to go there. This is awful, right? And they've internalized that in many ways. And so they resist the advertising and they resist the availability of it because the parents have reinforced to them, no, this is not good, you know. Now, if they were to step their foot in it and taste the French fries, I don't know if that would change, for example. But it's starting a path of saying, of almost stigmatizing, you know, stepping into McDonald's, right? And I think that is a facet of what class means and how class matters in this issue. That's just my own anecdotal
observation. Right.
Yeah. No, that's a great one. That's really good. And I think too, there's like different types of eating or shopping, I should say, for food. So when you do your supermarket shopping, you most likely have a list or have some idea of what you're going to get. And so you go in with a purpose and you walk into the store and the first thing you see is chips all over, you know, the front. There's an aisle promoting chips or this whole end of aisle crap. So you might not have chips on your list, but all of a sudden then that doesn't look like such a bad choice, right? You're just going to throw in one bag or, you know, your kids are with you and they're going to nag you for it. And all throughout the store, you're going to run into these opportunities to make what are impulse buys that sort of that would undermine anyone's effort to try to shop healthier. So I think that's one thing that happens within the store level. And then so there's food shopping. And you know, I think low-income people in particular are very conscientious about what they're picking and the costs. You know, how much impulse buying they do, I don't know. I have not looked at those studies, but it'd be interesting because I think they have such, you know, you're really working on a limited income. But the other side of that is there are all these other opportunities besides your monthly shopping to eat. So, you know, it's the fast food places. It's the corner stores. I spent the last couple years walking around with my little handheld camera and taking pictures of every retail outlet I went into that sold food that was not related to food. And it was fascinating to me how many different outlets had at least a display full of candy and a cooler full of soda. Everything from, you know, auto parts stores to libraries to, you know, it was everywhere. So that's where I think a lot of these extra calories come in too, is that you can eat, you know, three meals a day, but then you have all these other chances to be eating lots of other food, which is most likely kind of low in nutrient quality and, you know, fulfills that instant need because, you know, it's right there. So, and let's face it, food marketers spend billions of dollars a year getting us to do that. So.
Right. And to walk down the center of the aisle rather than the outside of the supermarket.
Yeah.
You know, it is real. I wanted to begin when we were both talking about this a minute ago, though, it becomes this question on our way back to talking about food deserts and obesity. This idea, I think you use the word, Helen Lee, foodies.
Mm-hmm.
And when that becomes, again, it feels like we're almost, that this whole question around food becomes a question of an elitist other. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
yeah.
And who can afford to be foodies? I mean, mm-hmm. and what that means and how this whole healthy food revolution taking place
mm-hmm.
is expensive.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. So I wonder how that much of a factor plays into all of it as well, and as well as where the markets want to put themselves.
Oh, you mean the supermarkets?
Yeah.
That's a good
I think, well, I think, I mean, if you think of, I know Alice Waters was part of Michelle Obama's campaign, and I think her initiative was really, or her passion is about, you know, community gardens, right?
Right.
And getting kids to understand how things grow and to see, you know, the seed come into a plant and reap that and cook that. And in doing so, they will get a greater appreciation of what a healthy food is. And I don't think that's not valuable. I think that instilling that is a good thing. how far it will go, again, is questionable, I think, because of all the other things that surround children, and that they are wired to, as Kessler points out, who is former head of the FDA, you know, these bliss points that were biologically triggered to crave and to want. This is combination of sugar, fat, and salt.
Right.
And,
right.
Products are geared toward us to hit those points, you know, in very clever ways. And so I think it's one component, but it's also to fight that battle every day, there has to be something beyond, you know, the education, let's grow our own vegetables kind of component. and I think this is where the foodie movement a little bit falls short. And this is not to say that they all do this, but it's to say that we have to look more broadly beyond the immediate, you know, let's grow kale, and say, you know, what is it about higher income folks, higher SES folks, socioeconomic status folks, and their health that we can then model and translate to improve the health of those who, with less resources, who are more disadvantaged. And we're not going to be able to do that entirely, but to the extent that we can, you know, sort of learn some lessons about why folks, you know, choose the healthier way and mimic that, I think that's an important step. And I think it's not just about, you know, finding ways to grow kale that's really, or eat kale that's that's innovative in particular ways.
Helen, do you eat kale?
What's that?
Do you eat kale?
I do.
Okay, just checking.
Are you a foodie, Helen?
Yeah. I'm kind of a foodie, but I definitely like kale, and I found a way to cook it that I like, that makes it tasty
in
to me.
It's
called soy sauce, which is good.
You want to take us a break with a thought, Anne, and then we're going to take a short break.
Sure. I think we underestimate the power of food marketing, and that, you know, a couple of the studies I've read that look at foods in schools, it's the only way to keep kids from purchasing unhealthy food choices in schools is if they are eliminated entirely. If you take them out of the school store or remove them during certain hours, you know, when they're in the lunch line or you turn out the vending machines, it's limited in effectiveness, and it's limited because they still want the foods. And so if, as soon as you change it, they just pick a different source. So I think that kind of goes back to this whole idea is that, you know, we're smarter than the marketers, or we'll be able to kind of figure out how not to purchase it, even though they're figuring out all the ways to tell us we do want to purchase this. And I think we need to pay attention to just how powerful that force is, especially in young people's lives. You know, my own kids, I crack up because sometimes they're watching TV and they'll come in and tell me we have to try some new food. And, you know, here I am like, you know, media literacy mom, you know, you got to learn how to, this is what they're trying to sell you and da, da, da. And still they're like, Mom, did you hear about this? There's this new cereal. This was on TV. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know, you just bought right into it. So it's kind of fast. You know, it doesn't matter. It's like they're still kind of get wrapped up in all of the hoopla around it and how cool it looks and look at who else is doing it. And, you know, we're all prone to it. And so it makes our jobs as public health people much harder.
So I'm going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'm going to try to wrap this around back to our food deserts, no food deserts, and what people should or could be doing. And we'll come back to that. Stay with us. We're here with Dr. Helen Lee and Anne Palmer. Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm here with Ann Palmer, Eating for the Future Program Director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Livable Future here in our studios. Dr. Helen Lee joining us from California. She's Public Policy Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. This is inspired by the article written by this Soundbites episode by Gina Colata in the New York Times on food deserts. Studies question the pairing of food deserts and obesity. Dr. Helen Lee was mentioned in the article, and we had to jump off from a conversation between two people who do some writing and thinking and researching about that in this portion of Soundbites. So it might sound strange, but why should we care whether people eat healthy or not? Is it a personal choice? And there are a lot of probably more libertarian conservative thinkers who would say, yes, it's a personal choice. It's up to somebody's own decision, and we should get out of this whole business of trying to see that people eat healthy, mm-hmm. whether they're in food deserts or food swamps, as someone said in the article. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? Helen, then we'll go to Ann.
Sure, yeah, I've definitely heard that point of view expressed. And my answer to that is that on some level, you know, you can't entirely regulate it, right? And there's only so much you can do from a policy perspective. That said, the why we should care question, I think, is starting to manifest itself in really in many ways in terms of escalating healthcare costs and disease prevalence that we ultimately all bear the burden of because we're taxpayers. So the rise, for example, in type 2 diabetes among children is notable, and it's not trivial, and that is directly related to the increase in childhood obesity. And so, and to the extent that that's borne out by Medi-Cal and Medicare, and that we ultimately pay for that, we should care. Mm-hmm. We should care about reducing those costs. We should care about improving longevity and workforce productivity. And I think what's startling about when you see it among children is that once it starts, you know, once a child becomes obese and then morbidly obese, it's very hard to reverse. That we know. And so the earlier you can intervene, I think this was the motivation for Michelle Obama's campaign, the earlier you intervene, the better chance you have. You know, it's sort of setting the life course right earlier on.
Ann?
I think my work in Baltimore has really taught me that so much of this is really an issue of social justice and around what happens in our city, and just seeing the unequal access and the lack of access to all kinds of services and amenities that middle and upper income neighborhoods take for granted. And you go into some of the lower income neighborhoods in Baltimore City and they're just not available. There was a study done in Baltimore City a number of years ago that looked at life expectancy. And in Southwest Baltimore, people have a 20-year lower life expectancy than residents that live in Roland Park, which is a upper to middle income neighborhood. And that's shocking. And a lot of that is diet-related disease, and we can attribute that, you know, to that there's the relationship. Something's going on here. What's happening in those neighborhoods that is causing people not to live as long?
So that brings us back to the question of access.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think, you know, access is a simple – it's a measure that we need to include in an overall picture of the larger food system. It's all part of it. I mean, there has to be a supply. There has to be demand. There has to be a lot of, you know, factors that are going to that we need to bring to bear upon it to make a difference. And, you know, it's not enough to just put – and I don't think anybody's saying this. It's not enough to just put a supermarket in a neighborhood and think that you're going to change people's behavior.
So it becomes a question of access and just changing the way people kind of think in some ways. I mean, we've had people on the show before who live in inner city neighborhoods who have created gardens. We did one just the other week, and how it's changed people's lives just in terms of growing food and tasting different kind of food, and it begins to make people begin to change it because the food is better. So the question is, I mean, are there any – are there any places that you know where this actually is changing and working anywhere in America? I mean, we had Will Allen on here, I guess about a month or so ago when we met him at the Center for Livable Future and did our interview with him there. And he was talking about trying to open grocery stores that are associated with the urban farms that they have going in Milwaukee. And one of the questions I asked was about that was that, you know, he sells a lot of it to restaurants and institutions, the food, because they can make money on the food that way. So, but, and we know that through subsidies, food is cheaper than it really costs to make often. But if we let the food prices raise so you can eat healthier food, how do people who are on limited incomes buy that food? Go ahead, jump in, Ann.
So one example, I mean, I think we are really fortunate in Baltimore City in many ways because I think we have a lot of people working on this issue and are, you know, with limited science available and trying to make the best decisions with what they know now. I do think the cost issue in terms of, you know, is it more, it's more expensive to be a foodie, and that certainly is the case. I look at some place like Real Food Farm, where they're doing some institutional sales, and then they also sell at stands in the neighborhood, that can offset the cost. You've got some customers who can afford to pay more for a premium product and then other customers who cannot. So if your wholesalers are willing to pay a higher price, then you can not get as high a price. You can afford to take a little bit less from, you know, neighborhood people who are not going to have as much money, or give them somewhat of a discount. So I feel like, in, you know, we've got a lot of great innovations going on in Baltimore that I'm really excited about and feel like we have a lot to be proud of, with our food policy director, with the mayor who's paying attention to what's happening in the public markets, trying to promote the food choices there that are healthier and indicating those on labeling, with all this urban farms that are going on, with the food stamp benefits and farmers markets. You know, there's all kinds of stuff that's happening. Is there a place where it all comes together? I don't know. I feel like it's oftentimes they're not orchestrated, and they're not, when you say working, working to me means that these are, you know, things, there's a system out there that we're trying to influence. And so we are looking at the policies and the programs and building partnerships with each other to make sure we're doing the best we can with what is available to us. Is there, I don't know if there's like a model city out there. There are a lot of cities doing fabulous work, Cleveland and Detroit and Milwaukee and, you know, lots of places out in California. We have a saying in Baltimore that if it's not happening in California, it's probably not happening. So Helen can probably speak to a lot of those places.
I think there's a lot of initiatives going on right now that are trying to address all these different factors. But I think it's really hard at the same time, because I think some of this is beyond, you know, for example, local level politics. Food pricing is sort of more macro, for example. But, you know, I'd love to hear more from Ann. I don't know about the in-depth studies that have evaluated them, and that's what I would like to see sort of in the long run. And again, emphasizing the fact that, you know, maybe obesity is not the ultimate outcome. Maybe obesity remains the same, but we see different consumption patterns that are healthier in some ways. I know that there's been a lot of focus on the school environment as well, and changing nutrition in the school environment, making school meals healthier. We know a lot of kids do get free and subsidized lunches and breakfasts. Mm-hmm. And so to say that those meals, the content of those meals can become healthier, that's, I think, an important step in the right direction. It's also teaching children, you know, so when they go to school and they go home, that they're trying to get them, give them a consistent message about what is good eating. I think schools and homes need to work together as well.
And that's a great policy. I mean, that looking at the federal government in terms of, you know, school lunch reimbursements and being able to, you know, use that lever to influence what the food nutrition directors purchase and can cook. And
so if I ask the question often in different ways, but if you could make policy without having to worry about political reality, what would you two do? What would you do?
let me count the ways.
I know. Oh, boy.
How long do we have? No. Okay. Well, one policy. Let me just start. I'll start really small, okay. Macro policy. But if you're, you know, looking at just how marketing happens, In a store. So working in the store environment has made me very conscious of what's happening at that level. So, you know, food distributors and they buy shelf space. And so the premium shelf space is for, you know, the products they want sold. So not, you know, if you had a way of manipulating what was in the store level from a policy perspective. So each chain, especially if you're for any food chain, if any supermarket, you could say, you know, the marketing of unhealthy food has got to be equivalent to the marketing of healthy food. Where are the healthy food products? How do people know? You have to, you know, by law, you would have to have something. I mean, menu labeling would be another one, I think, that would be an easy win, because I think there is calorie labeling can be incredibly powerful. You also have to couple that with people knowing, you know, how many calories do they need to have in a day, and making sure that can have an influence. Food marketing to children, to me, you know, that's, I believe, many European countries don't even allow that. And we really seem to have, you know, no holds barred in terms of our capitalistic approach to how we treat our children, and that is wrong. I don't agree with that. And I think that we need to look at that from a public health, put the public health equation in there, and really consider what that means, since they're not making mm-hmm. good decisions. Trans fat bans, I think those are, you know, some of those are already in place. What other things would I think of? Go ahead, Helen.
Helen, what about you?
Sure, I'll start small and then big. The smaller would be, and I don't know, Anne would know more about how much this is being done at the local level and in Baltimore, for example, but sort of cooking classes, you know, education classes that focus on, okay, you have a $100 budget, you go into the store, what should you buy, and how are you going to make, you know, tasty meals that your kids will eat from that, and, you know, and reduce waste, which is a salient concern among low-income families. You know, they don't have the luxury to throw things away if their kids don't eat them. So really, how do you maximize your budget at a food store and not produce waste? So I think that we need more of, and I haven't seen a lot of that going on. But that, I think, is an important component of getting people to eat healthier and see the value in that, and see that it doesn't have to be so so distasteful in some ways. And then the other issue would be, you know, there's something going on with poverty, and it's beyond food deserts, right? And I made the point earlier that, you know, we've seen obesity rise among all groups, but of course it's risen fastest among those who are poor. And in that way, it's reverse of, you know, developing nations, where those who are wealthier tend to be fatter. And so there is something going on with poverty, and to the extent that we can wrap obesity in anti-poverty policies, and there's a host of them that we can think of, then I think that's sort of a more holistic approach to tackling this issue. It's not just about weight. It's actually about well-being. It's about health and empowerment over the life course. It's about if you're born in a poor neighborhood, you don't have to stay in a poor neighborhood. You have opportunities for mobility. These things, you know, these orientations, they matter a lot. You know, this idea of locus of control, of agency, they are hugely predictive of your health over the life course. And I think this is part and parcel to what's going on with obesity.
I'd add one more thing to that. Incentivize more healthy food purchasing. So if you're somebody who's getting SNAP benefits, food stamp benefits, that if you are purchasing fruits and vegetables, frozen, fresh, whatever, that they would double those dollars, that they would have some way to make there an extra incentive for purchasing that, so the cost isn't as much of a factor when people are calculating that in.
So, and one of the things that kind of coming back to the core of the issue, I mean, I'd like to see Helen's response, the issue of lack of access to healthy food, you label, though, and others at CLF label, at the Center for a Livable Future, as a crisis. It's just not a small issue.
I think it's emblematic. And we work on food systems issues
right
at CLF. So I think it's emblematic of a larger problem. But I do think it is I don't know if I would say that it's like an insurmountable problem, but I feel like it's so multifaceted that the more you become aware of all those actors and different components working together, the more you realize if you're just focusing on one of those, you're going to have limited impact on the problem. Mm-hmm. And as Helen said, you know, we often go back to I teach an urban food systems class, and we go back to this. As you start to untangle it and look at the root causes, you find that poverty is another, just, you know, it's a driver for a lot of this, as Helen said. And I think not, you know, we talk about livable wages. We talk about people being able to have access to jobs. I believe one of the studies looked at mothers' education level just being protective of obesity in general. How do you, you know, move people to a place where they can actually, you know, start to think about the health of their families and not be so worried about making ends meet? Mm-hmm. And I think that is, you know, that's, that anxiety is real. And I remember reading a study a few years ago that looked at when purchasing patterns change in an income level. And it, when people, it, people were basically shopping to feed their families, to stop their families from being hungry, until they got to the level of, and this is for a family of four, at about $60,000, they started to purchase food with the idea that they, health was a factor in determining what they were buying. And that's a huge gap. If you mm-hmm. think, you know, the poverty level, what our current poverty level is, up to $60,000, that's a lot of people who are really just trying to get by and take care of their families the best they can with the money that they have and with those means. And that doesn't allow for a lot of, you know, options and a lot of mistakes in your food purchasing. You've got to be very, you know, calculated about it.
So were you about to say something, Helen? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, no, no.
One of the things that I mean, you know, when we first read the article, I sent it, read the article that where you were quoted, Helen Leah, to over to Anne and others at the Center for Livable Future. I mean, just to comment on what they thought the article was saying, I really, what, where you two are coming from with this, there isn't that much of a gap.
No.
No. I think we're on the same page.
Actually, Helen, I went and read your study. I didn't really even, I have to be honest, I didn't really even read the article because I just don't bother because it's like, what's the point, you know? Really? I need to read your study so I could understand it. And I read her study and was like, oh, I totally agree with this. Like this, I understand. You know, it's like, that's different than when you're laying it out for a...
Because that's why this is important. I mean, because one of the things, Helen, that I think that makes this conversation so important is because we, the media, of which I am a part, has a tendency to do things that grab a headline.
Right.
That can titillate, like it's, you know, the, like as if you read the headline and you think that there's no connection between food deserts or poverty and obesity. And mm-hmm. that's the sense that you get from reading it, but that's not the sense of what you're really saying.
Well, I mean, what I did say in the study, and this is why I got the headline, was that it doesn't seem to matter. You know, it doesn't seem to predict whether you're going to be obese or you're going to become obese among children. That is the that whether you live in a food desert or not doesn't seem to predict that outcome. But there's a lot of caveats in the study as well, which suggest that where I state, you know, I don't know about the quality of the food stores, for example. I just know that there's a lot of them in poor neighborhoods. I also don't know about other outcomes that might be equally as salient to study, including greater consumption of fruits and vegetables, for example. I only know about obesity. And so there's a couple of, you know, I think caveats, and I think once people read the study, they understood that I was trying to contextualize the finding in this broader literature. But I wasn't saying, you know, some of the pushback that I got was that, oh, you're saying food deserts are mythical, and so why does the government have this whole thing where it's identifying food deserts? You know?
Right.
How can I identify something that's mythical? And I'm not saying that, and I actually make it very clear that I'm not saying that food deserts are mythical. I think they do exist. I don't think they're patterned the way that they've been portrayed. They're actually patterned the way that they've been, you know, portrayed in the media, which is that, and in some research, that, you know, poor neighborhoods are just these dwarfs of, you know, they're just you know, vacuous of healthy food options. I think that's not true. So that's actually the finding that seemed to get a lot of headlines, you know,
right.
was the food desert argument. But this latter argument, you know, that it doesn't have a connection to obesity, I think a lot of people understand that that's part of it. I mean, there's no one factor that can really drive it, right? It's really multifaceted, and I think all public health practitioners understand that.
Right.
Yeah.
And?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I mean, I think that what she's bringing up is really important, that it isn't, you know, we look for causality because we want there to be a simple solution. And when there's not a simple solution,
right.
we get frustrated and we say, oh,
exactly.
put our hands up. You know, it's like, hello. No, you know, that's – I think that just takes away from the fact that we have to look at the greater system. And looking at the greater system requires a lot longer attention span than most of us seem to have. And it requires bringing to bear a lot of different resources that, you know, it's complicated. It requires efforts from, you know, policymakers, store owners, you know, everybody.
Yeah. And that's part of what we're trying to do here on Soundbites.
Yeah.
And Soundbites on Dharma is to kind of raise this conversation so we can keep it in the public's eye. And in the coming months, you're going to be hearing conversations with a number of farmers who have left industrial farming and why here and around and hear their stories, what we're doing. We're going to be talking a great deal about continue looking at food deserts and what's going on in urban and rural areas with people struggling to look for food. We're going to be tackling the farm bill. We're going to be tackling a number of issues about the future of farming in America. And so you can stay with us for that, but not today, in the coming weeks. I do want to thank our guests. This has been really interesting. Both the articles, the blog from CLF and the article from the New York Times and Helen Lee's research and other research you can link to here at on our Soundbites website. And we want to thank Ann Palmer, Eating for the Future Program Director for the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, and Dr. Helen Lee, Policy Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, for joining us. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538.